Greetings and welcome to Lobes and Robes, How Neuroscience Can Change the World. This podcast is sponsored by the American University Center for Neuroscience and Behavior and explores the links between neuroscience and key policy questions today. I'm Susan Carl, a professor of law at American University Washington College of Law, and I will help lead discussions throughout our series along with Dr. Terry Davidson, director of the Center for Neuroscience and Behavior at American University and a distinguished professor of neuroscience here. This podcast is for anyone interested in how scientific discovery can make the world a better place. Thanks for listening.
Greetings, everyone. Today, we are really excited to bring a researcher who's focused on the neurobiological mechanisms of human emotion, agency, flexibility, and has written a really terrific paper that came to our attention, and we wanted to talk to her about it. Our guest is Dr. Tara White, who is an assistant professor of behavioral and social sciences at Brown University. Her research focuses on human emotion and drug effects. It is multidisciplinary and uses MRI assessments and other kinds of assessments to study the neuroscience of emotion and structural, functional, and metabolic brain mechanisms of personal agency, emotional flexibility, fearlessness, risk-taking, and bonding in healthy young adults. She focuses on individual differences in the brain, mood and behavioral responses, and also attention to certain kinds of psychostimulants. She's also written a wonderful paper entitled The Neuroscience of Human Dignity. It's gotten a lot of attention, and we wanted to talk to her about that interdisciplinary work as well. So welcome so much, Dr. White. We're really happy to have you on the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for joining us today, Dr. White. I'm very much interested in your work, and I'd like to know how you came about to doing this type of research. So if you could tell us a little bit about your background, and perhaps also just basically how you became interested in a lot of diverse research approaches, in that you have ideas and concepts from neuroscience, psychological science, and philosophy that seem to be integrated in what you do.
First of all, I have to say thank you so much for inviting me to be a part of this conversation about the intersection between the legal system and neuroscience. I just think it's absolutely fantastic. And I just love the name of your podcast, by the way, Lobes and Robes. I'm sorry. It's spectacular.
Thanks so much.
So I think today we were talking about focusing on these ideas in dignity neuroscience, but we can back up. So I think this is the classic question of how do people get where they go and where they are. You know, my work, I've always been fascinated by the intersection between all things sort of biology and psychology. So I've sort of in my, development and even as a young person sort of bounced between those ideas. So this is kind of how I came to, study the wide range of things that I have, in part because I've just always, since a very young age, just really been interested in what is it that makes us who we are as individuals over time. How does that dance of biology and context unfold over time to make us who we are? And also, what are the things that shape, our feelings, our thoughts, the ways we're able to make meaning in the world? So these are the things that drive me. And given this kind of scope of that interest, it's probably inevitable that I would end up doing sort of a wide range of things. But I think the questions of agency and impact and meaning, how we create those things for ourselves, how we create them jointly with others, I think those are some of the most important questions we could be asking. And I think it's really fun and intriguing and exciting to me that these are questions you can interrogate across disciplines. So for instance, the work that you, Susan, are doing in theorizing agency on the legal side. I mean, that's an amazing and different and rich viewpoint on agency than you would get from a biological systems approach, than you would get from an evolutionary approach, than you would get from a psychological approach. So I think that in kind of interrogating these larger questions of how we make meaning and impact in our world. It's just really an exciting place to be, where we can really reach across disciplines and understand these really important phenomena.
I share with you the interest in neuroscience and psychology, and you probably know there was a time where neuroscience was a part of psychology. Now it seems to be becoming more independent.
Yeah.
The thing that makes you unique, at least in my perspective, is that you look like you're kind of starting a field in dignity neuroscience. And that's a term I haven't seen much in neuroscience, what you might call classical or traditional, or in psychological science. So can you tell us what you mean by that term and what led you to write the paper, where you want to go with the concept?
Sure, absolutely. So dignity neuroscience is a term I coined to describe a field of inquiry and understanding about what are the links between neuroscience and human rights. And what are the ways that we can use that sort of growing body of knowledge in both neuroscience and human rights to inform, you know, our own actions and the way that we construct our society? I came to this idea. It's one of those emergent phenomena. You know, life is not a straight line. Pre-pandemic, I was able to serve as an international visiting fellow with the British Academy. So I'm normally housed at Brown University here on the East Coast, and I had applied to this program because I was intrigued in seeding international collaborations, especially in MRI. And so I had this opportunity to spend like 6 months with my family at the University of Cambridge in the UK. And in part of that experience, the British Academy was at the same time had a really wonderful conference on international human rights and global development goals. So they, as a fellow, they just sort of, I think, of course, invited me because I was in country the day that the conference was being held. And I thought, you know, human rights, I mean, these are things I've been interested in. I've had no training in that. I have no, you know, official background in that. My work's not in that area. But I thought, that's just fascinating. So I was just absolutely excited to be in the room with scholars across the world who are working in law, in government, in nonprofits, sort of from boots on the ground to the highest levels of scholarly thought in the area of human rights. The conference was amazing. And so, of course, I'm situated at the back of the room. You know, I was probably the only behavioral scientist in the group. You know, the acronyms, of course, this is a meeting of experts for experts, and the acronyms are flying thick and fast, and the ideas are just, yeah, they're just bandying about because, and of course, these are terminal. I just started writing things down, right? Just to keep track of what they're talking about. It's just a completely different world from either psychology or neuroscience. And I was really struck in that meeting about a couple of things. So the first was, I mean, this is the global work of a lifetime. I mean, what could be more important than doing this work in understanding and fostering and supporting and defending human rights, you know, internationally, but also nationally and locally. So that was the first thing that struck me. The second thing was more emergent during that meeting. And it emerged not only in some of the talks, but also during the coffee breaks and just talking with people as we're, you know, sort of milling about the room. And that was really this sort of underlying sense of, I mean, despair might be too strong a word, but really sort of a deep-seated unease and concern that despite all of our ideals and international agreements since 1948, in this space of human rights, that we were somehow failing to achieve those aims sort of on a regular basis. And not only that, but that when human rights abuses occur, that they're often occurring with impunity. And so there's this sort of undercurrent of despair is really too strong, but this undercurrent of deep, deep and lasting concern and frustration that despite every best effort of these very, very smart and committed people, that we are still running into these systematic human rights issues and abuses and violations. So that was the second thing that struck me. The third thing that struck me in this meeting was that these ideas, and these are some of the most important ideas, I think, of our time, are grounded and basically intellectually based in a solitary concept And that concept is the concept of intrinsic human dignity. Now, that idea, human dignity, is the idea that each individual person has intrinsic value and worth. And that worth is unconditional. It's not conditioned upon any characteristic of that individual. It comes as a part of their humanity. So the fact that international and universal human rights are grounded in concepts of intrinsic human dignity is profoundly important. But it also creates a bit of a problem, in part because this idea of intrinsic human dignity is really undefined. It's been undefined in almost every domain we've tried to grapple with what dignity means and what dignity entails. So all of these ideas at the international level are really grounded in a construct that is largely undefined. And then operationally at the international level, you know, just hearing about these many international agreements and treaties and covenants are sort of operationally defined by mutual agreement. So if we have ideas of international human rights, which are profoundly important for our health as both individuals and as a society, that are grounded in a concept that's largely undefined and sort of executed in a way that is dependent entirely upon our mutual agreement on what those rights are, that creates a situation that is sort of ripe for abuse, in that, you know, nation states, individual dictators, individual leaders, it gives them room to withdraw from the agreement and say, we no longer believe that these rights are hold for this group or in this scenario or what have you. So those were the things that I noticed in this meeting as I sat in the back of the room trying to absorb what human rights are. And about two-thirds of the way through the day, I'd say around 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm trying to, you know, as I'm learning about human rights, I'm creating categories. I'm like, well, okay, rights to life, liberty, these are really about agency. You know, these issues of poverty that are especially in the global development goals are really having to do with freedom from want. Protection from abuse is really about freedom from fear. There's many of these rights have to do with the rights to ownership of your creative product as either a scientist or an artist or a creator. So those are rights to uniqueness. And then sort of baked into the concept of the universality of human rights is the idea of unconditionality, that these rights are not conditional upon any internal or external context, that it is an outflow of our humanity and that they hold across contexts. And the moment that I realized the importance of this unconditionality construct is when you start to, as we were in this room, grappling with issues of statelessness, where, you know, you really have been defined as not being a citizen of any nation. And as a result, you are basically without any rights because they're not defensible in any court because you don't have standing. So you have basically fallen through every crack that there is in the system. And so that really, to me, was a sort of a lightning strike about the importance of unconditional belonging in the human community for the defense of these rights. And so putting together these different categories, it just hit me really like a lightning bolt out of the blue that literally all of my training, you know, in the back of the room as a behavioral scientist in psychology and in neuroscience is directly relevant to these domains of dignity, to these domains of human rights, and to this larger human rights endeavor.
I agree. I think these connections are so exciting to explore and to identify. And I'm wondering, especially around the concept of human agency, can you describe a little bit about how you approach that in your paper and actually in all of your work? What does that mean from a neuroscience perspective?
I love that you bring this up because agency is one of my favorite topics.
Yeah, mine too.
So I see agency as the place where motivation leads to action in the nervous system. But from a subjective experience standpoint, you know, what it means in our everyday lives, agency is really your ability to take action in the world that's voluntary. It's your ability to take the action and impact that you want in the world around you. I came to ideas of agency in part because my training originated in grad school in the neurobiology of emotion and temperament. And agency is very much a part of that space in the personality world. It's falling inside constructs of extroversion and positive affect, feelings of surgency and confidence and accomplishment. These are all parts and parcel of what agency feels like from the inside and the way that we express it emotionally. So there's both, you know, you can explore this, these ideas using measures of state emotion. So those would be feelings of like excitement, engagement, interest, enthusiasm, vigor. And then also from a trait perspective, so these would be measures of more stable sort of experiences of those states and the frequency and intensity with which they're elicited in your everyday life. So it would manifest as a dimension of basically agentic extroversion, basically it encapsulates some aspects of social leadership, your comfort in sort of directing events around you, both for yourself and for groups of people, and sort of the flexibility and the persistence of pursuing goals in the environment that then can lead to, you know, positive states and positive outcomes. So just from the sheer emotional side, the effective science, effective neuroscience side, you can really learn a lot about agency by looking at both states of emotion and traits of emotion that are relevant to these phenomena.
You mentioned that definition, of course, is important, and that's a difficult thing to do when I think you're trying to translate concept to a brain structure or a brain circuit. So terms like emotion and dignity and volition, even, it seemed to be that you're struggling with a definition that you might be able to give to other neuroscientists, so they would then be able to track or at least try to determine what areas of the brain are contributing to those functions. I see that as a problem. Do you see that as something that has to be overcome?
I don't think that we are struggling with a definition of agency from the psychological side. It's possible I just didn't articulate it in a way that translates into the kinds of things that you're working on. From the trait side and the state side, agency involves the activation of incentive motivational circuitry. So these would be dopaminergic circuits that are originating in areas like the ventral tegmental area that are providing widespread arching dopaminergic input into frontal brain and the limbic system. So, and there's been a lot of work in personality and states of positive activated emotion that indicates that these pathways are involved in both episodes, sort of temporary episodes of agentic states, but also trait-wise variation in the experience of those states. So I see it less as a definitional issue than as maybe a question of interpretation and scope and the realization that, you know, many of the important topics we're looking at in both psychology and neuroscience are actually engaging in this idea and these concepts. I would offer that, you know, on the clinical side, things like learned helplessness, depression, these, you can think of these as sort of ways in which agency has been derailed. And also in the world of addiction, you see that substance dependence and like alcohol dependence, substance use disorder, this is really a hijacking of natural processes of agency so that the individual does no longer really have total control over these agentic processes. They get hijacked by these drugs that are basically supernormal stimuli that are activating and controlling the circuitry. And so you get this hyperreactivity to cues that are related to the drug of choice. These effects ratchet back in time. They become conditioned to the environments in which drug use occurs. And so I think that there's ways of thinking about and sort of broadening our view about really important work done in both psychology and neuroscience. They are interrogating this construct of agency. I don't think it's been posed in that way many times before, but in this paper, I am connecting some of those dots.
Yeah. So from a layperson's perspective, but I'm also fascinated with the concept of agency, how it's used in law, how understandings have changed over time in law. I'm wondering, is part of what you're trying to do is to help with policy interventions that would help with individual empowerment? So for example, being able to escape from an abusive relationship, being able to overcome, you know, substance abuse disorder, or other ways in which people have a goal or desire that they want to achieve, but are having trouble being able to take the right steps to go there. Is that part of what this research is about, or is it too early to sort of start translating that way?
You know, I love this idea because I think that this is a direction that this work could go in, most definitely. I articulated these connections between these domains of dignity and these domains of human rights and what we know about neurobiological functioning in humans, in part because I want to be able to support, you know, to provide an additional sort of pillar of strength underneath these ideas of human rights at the international level, but also in terms of the way that we're engaging in our own lives, you know, the way we're interpreting the events that happen to us and the ways that we can support the people around us. And I do think that there are going to be some really exciting policy implications of this. In terms of empowerment, I think our culture is very agency-centric and centered and driven. And I think, you know, we would probably be having a different conversation if we were from a non-Western culture. We might be talking more about unconditionality and our involvement in the community. But in our Western culture, especially American culture, I think, you know, agency is just so important. And it's an important part of our self, the way we define the self, ourselves, our society, and what our goals and values are. And when you think about individual empowerment, I think, you know, in terms of impact on everyday life, you know, thinking hard about what goes into agency, the ways we can support agency, you know, in our lives and in the lives of everyone around us is really important. And I think that in many ways we're getting, it's not messaging from society, but it's very easy to sort of get down or somewhat deflated about our ability to do things or, you know, resist the Doritos as we're trying to relax or, you know, why can't I exercise first thing in the morning like the way everyone says I should? These are part of the daily struggle, right? But I think that agency is thinking about the ways that our neural circuits support this capacity and allow agency to emerge is an interesting and important part of the puzzle of how we're living our everyday lives. In terms of policy, like how we can bring ideas of the neuroscience of agency to bear to questions of abuse, how to get people out of abusive environments, how to support people in abusive environments, and to support their personal and emotional health and that transition out of those scenarios. And also, in a strange way, the ability and the compassion that we can bring to bear for people who are struggling with addiction and substance use disorder, which is its own, a similar prison in a way to being in an abusive environment, that your agency has been exteriorized. You no longer have control over your ability to make choices moment to moment because the drug has exteriorized your agency and you're being driven by those cues in ways that you don't want. In the same way that being in an abusive environment, that things are happening to you on a daily and moment-to-moment basis that are not what you want. I think that understanding and connecting with the ways in which our very bodies and minds are designed to help us have agency is, I think, a kind of a message of hope and also a way to intervene. I don't know if this is getting us in the right direction of what you were hoping for here in terms of, abuse and substance use disorder.
Yeah, absolutely. And Terry, I mean, you study addiction to food addiction and other kinds of addiction, looking at different part of the brain, as I understand it. But again, I'm a lay person. I'm wondering how does your work resonate with what Tara just said about
So I'm very interested in your approach. And I do think that we need to find ways in which we can understand human behavior, and that can affect the legal system and policy. Of course, you probably know that neuroscientists have been rather deterministic in its approach. And so it's not a way that people like to, I think most people like to think about it, but we tend to look at the brain as a machine and it will malfunction. And what we need to do is try to either prevent the malfunction or correct it when it happens. And in that sense, we don't basically ascribe agency, if I'm understanding the term correctly, to machines. And so in that sense, we wouldn't ascribe it to the brain. Somehow, I think we need to be able to cross that gap. And I'm very interested in doing that. And I think one of the things you're trying to do is to accomplish that. So, I mean, I understand the effort you're trying to make. I'm not sure how I can fit it into what I'm doing.
Yeah. So I love this observation. I think our goal here is the same.
Yeah.
Is in terms of understanding the ways that these systems not only operate, but how we can connect with those systems. I think as part of the larger culture, like this idea of brain as machine is probably a very, Susan, you can probably have a much larger sort of timeline in terms of the thought on this, but brain as machine strikes me as a fairly modern concept, right? And I
agree. Yeah.
Personally, I think that it's maybe led us down a path that's less useful than one might think, in part because the brain is not a machine. The brain is not a computer. The brain is embodied, and our bodies are within a context. I think, Susan, you got to some of this in your article, which was fantastic, on theorizing agency about the fact that we are existing within a social and physical context. And I think we need to be very sensitive to the fact that the brain is neither a machine nor a computer, and that it is a part of our biological heritage, that we are a biological organism, and also this, I think part of the ways in which as a machine or the brain is a computer, it sort of gets into this mind-body dualism too, right? That if the brain is part of the body and the body is different from the mind, then how can we ever, you know, why would we want to know? Sort of the neuroscience becomes threatening, right, to our ideas of mind.
Well, yeah. I mean, there's also monisms where people have said that thinking is to the brain as walking is to the legs, and that they're both atoms in motion. So again, these are philosophical views, and I don't believe that.
Yes, they are.
Right. Yeah, it's really difficult. And I think that's part of the issue here. How do we get across those things?
Yeah. Yeah.
In terms of the brain not being a machine, I understand that, but there's also different kinds of machines. There's biological machines as well. I guess it's just the term you want to put on it. And I think actually a lot of people don't like to think of themselves as machines. And I appreciate that. I don't either. But it's a strategy that some people will apply. A lot of neuroscientists will apply to try to understand what their subject matter.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think your point about that fact that neuroscience is often seen as deterministic. At some level, that's, I think, useful. I think at some other level, it really fails the larger endeavor of understanding the human condition, because I've given this some thought, because I do feel that is saying that there's a neuroscience of agency, does that suggest that agency is biologically determined or sort of neurobiologically predetermined, right? Does that mean that somehow the magic of the agency in everyday life is somehow diminished by having a neuroscientific understanding or ways of interrogating agency in everyday life? And I actually think the answer to that is a definitive no. And in part because I think trying to understand this and then posing the question is a neuroscience approach to agency deterministic? I think we can either, in thinking about these things, we can either try to be right or we could try to understand. And I would like to try to understand. And so I think by understanding something about the neurobiology or the neuroscience of agency, I don't think that means that agency is biologically determined. I would actually like to use an example from your area, which is learning and memory. So I think we're sort of in our infancy of understanding the neurobiology of agency. But we do know a ton about the neurobiology of learning, right? And it strikes me that, I mean, we know the circuits involved, we know the molecules involved, we know the time course, we know the things that modulate it, we know the things that can set learning awry, and we know the things that can improve learning. So I think we have a very, very advanced, it's one of the things we know the most about in the human central nervous system is the neurobiology of learning. And yet, not once have I ever had anyone say to me, gosh, you know, I'm feeling really depressed about learning because it's biologically determined, right?
Yeah.
So I think that that lays, you know, shines a light on the lie that understanding something about the neural circuits that support some capacity that we have, like learning or like agency, and that this neural circuitry from molecules to systems allows these capacities to emerge. I think that understanding something about that neurobiology doesn't mean that that capacity is biologically predetermined. Those are just my thoughts.
As you know, I've been studying learning and memory, and I haven't had to, matter of fact, in all my training, I've not had to think much about agency. And so what you're doing, right, is refreshing to me from allowing me to look at it from a different perspective. However, it's still an issue where, so for example, in your paper, you talk about contingency versus autonomy, not versus, as an example of autonomy. If I'm correct, so animals are very sensitive, so are people sensitive to contingencies. And because they're sensitive to contingencies, I guess probably should define, well, would you mind defining it for me so I don't miscite you when you what you mean by contingency?
So I think I did define it in the text, and I was very careful about that. But autonomy, I would say, is a state of not, that your choices are not determined by others, other agents in the space. So your choices have consequences. That's part of autonomy.
Right. So contingency means you learn what the consequences are. And essentially, you know, what's contingent upon what else?
I mean, you can learn what the consequences are, but that your actions have consequences is the definition of, in my view, I think, contingency.
Okay.
So the effects are contingent upon your actions. So for instance, experimentally, we would be able to study the impact of autonomy on learning by using a yoked control design. So in this design, only one of the animals or people, you know, has full autonomy in the space and is able to make mistakes and learn from those mistakes and take action and learn from those actions in a natural way. And then the control group, which is controlling for all the stimuli and the actions that were happening in the autonomy group, but it's a passive yoked control. So their actions are basically determined by the actions of the other animal. In the yoke control design, the contingency has been removed from the passive control condition.
One of the things that is interesting to me, and that is how far do we go with the autonomy based on contingency? So there are Hermacenda sea slugs that are sensitive to contingency. I mean, is this an evolutionary thing for people, or I understand, I'm just asking for opinions here. I know it's not like give me the correct answer now. I'm just trying to get your thoughts on this. So do species other than humans within your framework, would they have autonomy or agency?
Autonomy and or agency?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I was very careful in this paper. Absolutely. These are evolved systems that are allowing for emergent phenomena. Some of those phenomena include agency and the feelings we experience as positive, activated emotion, elation, surgency. You know, that's a real open question is how do other species experience these states? Do they experience them consciously, subjectively? Certainly we can see it behaviorally in models such as the sea slug that you describe. I think honestly, every time I get Zoom bombed by my daughter's cat, I think that that's an example of agency in another species, right?
Well, yeah.
Believe me, that behavior never happens unless I'm on a Zoom call, right? So,
yeah. So that's a very consistent position. And I do think that agency, like most of everything, has probably evolved. And it's most likely, and it also means then that if this is observable, or part of what organisms on the lower parts of the developmental scale, it looks like we can study them and to try to determine.
Absolutely.
Right. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think we could do it in multiple model systems. It doesn't have to be a a sea slug, and it doesn't have to be a human being. I think there's many intermediary models that we could interrogate. But I just wanted to do mention that in the Dignity Neuroscience paper, I was very, very careful not to cite any animal work because I didn't ever want to be in a situation where we're defining human rights and responsibilities individually and collectively based on animal data. This paper only cites human work, which is a strength, but I do feel very strongly that there will be exemplars of these phenomena in other species as well.
Absolutely. I want to go back just for a second. I think this was such a fascinating discussion between the two of you. But I think one thing that people who have not read your paper, Tara, might, so you described the two conditions in your study. One was the subject's head autonomy, and the other was the control group. Everything was yoked, meaning that nothing they did controlled the outcome. What were your findings about the differences? Were you, just so everybody understands the point of that important paper. Yeah.
Absolutely. So I was using this study design. This is not work I've done. This is sort of a review of many, many studies across areas in human neuroscience. It's just an example of the ways in which we can learn about and understand the neurobiology and the neurobiological systems that help support and contribute to this phenomena. And the thing is that autonomy is really an essential component of the learning process in humans. The data here are astoundingly consistent, and it almost doesn't matter what you're learning. Autonomy is critical to that process being effective. So whether you're learning to throw a ball a different way, you're learning to ride a bike, you're trying to learn some complex mathematical process, you're grappling with, you know, language in a new area, having autonomy in the way that you're engaging with those new stimuli and those new processes is absolutely critical to your speed and depth of the learning process. So without autonomy, learning doesn't work very well. And I think that this has been well interrogated in psychology, in motor learning and perceptual learning, visual learning. It's also relevant to things like learning additional methods for self-control, biofeedback. I mean, it's actually quite wild when you go across all these domains that autonomy is a huge contributor and modulator of learning. And it seems to be an essential part of the process in humans and also likely in other species. So I was just using that as one example of the ways in which we can see this and interrogate it in terms of the neuroscience that supports it.
We may have a difference of point of view here, which not surprising, but
sure.
Question I have. I actually trained with Robert Wiskorla, and Robert Wiskorla was one of the people who did a lot with contingencies. And so what I'm not understanding, or again, this just could be a point of disagreement, is why is contingency so closely equated with autonomy? I mean, I can see that you can interpret it that way, but why? You wouldn't have to, right? A contingency is just a relationship that animals are sensitive to. And if you don't have it, they, as in the yoke control designs, they don't learn as well.
I mean, it might be more of a sense of point of view.
Okay.
Your thought is that contingency, do you want to just describe, go into what your concern is about the difference between contingency and autonomy?
I'm not sure why they are so closely equated.
Having autonomy means that your actions have impact. And that your actions matter, right?
Sure.
And that you have the freedom to have those, take those actions and have that impact. And in cases where your autonomy has been constrained, so from a human rights standpoint, this would be cases where, say, someone's not like unlawful imprisonment or something, like someone has constrained you to your home and you're not allowed to get out and you don't have ability to take the action that you want. At that point, your ability to get out is without impact, right? So all the contingency has been removed. That's just sort of an extreme example. I think there's probably multiple ways of thinking about this.
Maybe that's the problem. I'm thinking about it a different way than you are. Yeah, obviously, when you're studying rats and hermacenda or sea slugs, we're not thinking about people actually being in situations where they have no control. So it may be that we're just coming at it from a different perspective.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. One thing that's interesting is when you actually talk about contingency, and Susan, you had mentioned things about alcohol, like substance use disorder and addiction. One of the more effective ways of treating and getting folks out of an acute addiction and dependence situation is what they call contingency management. So CM. Contingency management is really one of the sort of gold standard and initial ways of getting people out of this state. So I think contingencies are relevant to ideas about autonomy and agency. It's just, I think we've probably, and this is something I'm running into, and I think it's intrinsic to work that's multidisciplinary and interdisciplinary and pan-disciplinary even, is that aligned fields are often use the exact same words in slightly different ways that overlap just enough that you each think you're talking about exactly the same thing. But in fact, you're talking about things that are not quite. The Venn diagram is not completely overlapping, and sometimes it's only overlapping a very minimal amount. So contingency might be one of those words.
I think you're really capturing the problem. Susan and I are very much interested in translating, trying to bridge neuroscience and law, right? And I think this whole conversation is capturing some of the obstacles that we need to overcome. And a lot of them are conceptual. I think it's valuable that we're having this conversation. It just opens, at least in my mind, perhaps different ways of trying to accomplish that objective.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah. So I'm going to bump the conversation out like way too abstract. Terry will have something to say about that. But so it seems to me, and I understand you're using the word contingency in slightly different ways, and therefore the word autonomy, which is related, is different as well, and your views about it. But in terms of how one would think about this in a human rights framework, it seems to me it wouldn't only be things like imprisonment and those kinds of things, but also, you know, there's such a tension between the way some of the cultures and some governments think about the value of economic rights, protecting people's sort of basic standards of living, versus other systems that are so focused on free markets. And again, with the rhetoric of freedom, liberty, individual autonomy, and all of that. But some of this work kind of explains the need for both, right? Because again, if one is not living at a certain level of subsistence satisfaction, the ability to have agency is so greatly diminished. And on the other hand, even in a system that purports to protect liberty and autonomy and freedom, if the economic basics are not there for human flourishing, then that rhetoric is empty. And so I'm wondering, Tara, were you thinking at all about those kinds of things when you were working on this, sort of coining this concept of dignity neuroscience?
Yeah, I think that they're sort of a natural conversation between those spaces of like free markets as opposed to economic well-being, and how it intersects with these really fundamental human needs and requirements for flourishing. I think that the five domains that I'm talking about here in dignity neuroscience of, you know, agency, but also really the fundamental rights and universal rights to freedom from want and freedom from fear. These are separate domains, but they're also interrelated. As you said, you can't, you know, the freedom to, you know, learn and explore, it doesn't mean a lot if you're starving or if you're so ill that and you're without care that you really are functionally diminished in terms of your ability to interact with the world. So these things are all part and parcel of our needs as human beings to flourish. And I think a sensitivity to these, you know, rights and needs for freedom from want and freedom from fear, which is really, you know, the need to be free from abject poverty and from physical, emotional, and other types of mistreatment and maltreatment. Those are really the floor for flourishing. And you really can't have agency without having those really very important things in place, essential things in place.
It sounds like you learned a lot about human rights theory in a short space of time to be able to understand those fundamentals.
I consider myself very much a learner in this space. I really am hoping that I'm not stepping on any toes, but I'm sure that just in exploring these ideas, I will. And I apologize, but I really feel strongly that it's important that we, you know, sort of embrace the whole and the totality and the messiness of these ideas, because I think that's where these ideas of agency, freedom from want, freedom from fear, where they intersect. I think that there probably will be some policy implications of, like, what are the bounds in certain scenarios and certain situations? What supports do we need to provide as both individuals and as a society to make sure that we're honoring the dignity of all persons in our community?
By the way, I'll add that I don't think we've had any advancements in science or perhaps any field without somebody's toes getting stepped on.
Here it comes. I know. I agree.
That might be a pretty interesting place to end this conversation. I mean, I think there's so much more to discuss and explore. Terry, do you have any thoughts as we kind of wrap up?
I do, but unfortunately, I think if I got into these things with Tara, we'd have to go another 50 minutes. So,
well, we could do this again. I really have enjoyed meeting and talking with both of you about this. I mean, you're both very thoughtful and obviously intrepid in this space. Yeah. And I so appreciate that, because I feel like this is just a conversation, and a conversation is ongoing almost by definition. And so I'm hoping that we can talk about things further, either, you know, as an aside or even as part of this.
Now, you're the intrepid one. You're certainly going into areas that other folks haven't gone into, and you're diving in head first. And I appreciate what you're trying to accomplish.
Thank you. Yeah.
Well, wonderful. Maybe with that, we'll hope that we can have you on again.
I would love it.
Really, thank you for your time and all the wonderful work that you're doing. And thank you for being on the podcast.
Yes, thank you so much.
It's just such a pleasure. Yeah. Such a pleasure to talk with both of you. Yeah. Thanks.
Well, that's it for this podcast episode. Thanks very much for listening. And as always, we welcome your feedback at neuroscience.policy@american.edu. We hope you'll join us again for our next episode. And do let us know if there's anything in particular you'd like to hear more about.